So I'm here with Common Wheels Associate Editor Matthew Sittman, Common Wheels Digital Editor Griffin Olenek, and Common Wheels Managing Editor Kate Lucky. And we're here to sort of pick up on our feature in the December 1st issue, our annual Christmas Critics Roundup. And I think in some ways, Matt, you were saying as we sat down here, this is kind of the perfect Common Wheel project.
Yeah. Even when we first started even thinking about doing a podcast, we had joked about just putting a microphone down at our lunch table and recording our conversations, because often at lunch and even just stopping in one another's cubicles at work, we talk a lot about the movies we're watching, the music we're listening to, but probably most of all, the books we're reading.
Or the books that are piled on our desks.
Or the books that we hope to read, yeah. And so in a lot of ways, I would say this Christmas Critics, in this issue, I think since I've been here, this is the most editors of the magazine we've had in the feature. So that sort of provided a good opportunity for us to talk about, the four of us to sit down and talk about why we picked the books we picked, how we like to read, what's on our minds in terms of the books we might be reading in the future, and of course, a little bit about what we actually wrote in the Christmas Critics this year.
And one of the great things too, I think, while it was sort of heartening to me to see, was that among the four of us, there's kind of a wide range of selections in this Christmas Critics. Yeah. And Matt, I think, well, why don't I start with you, since you wrote about a writer that you've really come to love over the years.
Right. Yeah. I've never written about Edmund White, but he is one of my favorite writers. I've read a lot of his novels, but I really love his four memoirs. He's written four of them. I talk about all of them, at least briefly, in my review. And they really stretch from him moving to New York as a young graduate of the University of Michigan in the early 1960s. He was a gay guy who grew up in the Midwest and moved to New York in the 60s, through his latest memoir, which just came out this summer, actually.
And so did you rush out and grab that right away? And this is sort of what lined you up to do this for Christmas Critics? You're just like, hey, it's a great time to do it? Or how did you...
Yeah, well, I had actually thought about writing something longer that took off from Edmund White's memoir that came out this summer, which is called The Unpunished Vice, about his life in reading. It's a memoir of reading, his life in reading. And I thought about writing something longer about it. And then when it came time to do Christmas Critics this year, I just realized that often when we do Christmas Critics, we try to have some sort of theme, something that holds them together, and that Edmund White's four memoirs might just be a nice, simple little group of books to talk about together.
Yeah, it's interesting too. I like how sort of you mentioned themes, but there's sort of a serendipity to this, right, Griffin? I think, you know, what was the book that you sort of featured in your Christmas Critics?
I chose two. Both are about New York City. The first was Open City by Teju Cole, and the other was Patriot Number 1 by Lauren Hilgers. And I spent a lot of time thinking about New York just because this was the first time I had ever lived in New York City. And it's interesting that Matt brings up the concept of memoir. Teju Cole's book, Open City, is written kind of like a memoir, but it's actually a work of fiction. So he's able to kind of sublimate a lot of his own autobiographical interests into a fictional narrative with an alter ego and everything. So it's a bit like, for me, you know, it's like a modern Augustine, but it kind of works in reverse in that the confessions, you have this narrative of Augustine knowing that he's bad and wanting to become good. Mm-hmm. But what I found so interesting about Open City is you read it and this is a guy that he thinks he's so good and he comes to discover that he's bad.
Yeah. I think a lot of people have noticed that who've read Open City. I think some people have commented, you know, to that fact.
Yeah, I hear it's not too popular with teenagers.
just a disclaimer, I have a 15-year-old daughter who also read Open City this past summer, and she's a little bit in disagreement with Griffin's take on it in certain ways.
I heard that she threw the magazine across the room when she saw the review.
When she read Griffin's review. But, I mean, I guess it does sort of get to the topic of how we read and why we read, Kate. And you sort of, you had an interesting approach to your collection.
Yeah, so my reading this year has really taken place on trains and on buses. I now live in Connecticut. I have moved to the suburbs earlier than I thought that I would, but I have. So I selected small books, books that are very portable and easy to carry with me as I come to work. And one of the novels, or novellas, I should say, that I read this year was by this Icelandic writer that I read in translation, obviously, The Whispering Muse. And the author's name, I think, is pronounced Sjón. It's S-J-O-N. And he is a really interesting guy. He's a poet. He's also a lyricist. He's just a big literary figure in Iceland. But I had done an internship at a publishing house at FSG a few summers ago. And this was the book that I was given by one of the Publicity Associates and recommended to me as one of the best things they had published in years, which I found interesting because I had not heard of this writer and heard of all of his work that's been translated by this same woman, Victoria Cribb, into English. But it's just this great fable of a book about an academic who finds himself on a seafaring voyage with one of Jason's Argonauts, and they sit around the table every night and hear stories. The academic is really jealous because the Argonaut, Canis, can captivate audiences with his stories of metamorphosis and love and jealousy, and the academic has this dissertation about fish and Nordic ethnic superiority, and no one wants to listen to it. And so
I can't imagine why.
Right? So he's jealous, and so it's funny, and it also got me thinking about reading, because when you're reading a book like this, you're constantly switching between the sort of main clothesline thread of the narrative and the little myths and episodes that get narrated along the way. So you're being introduced into new characters in this fabulous world and then coming back to the dinner table. And the book's short, so these episodes are short, but it also just got me thinking about how you read a text like that, that's sort of in an old-fashioned style, like an Odyssey sort of style, where you're constantly being interrupted to hear about things that happened in the past, and those episodes wrap up nicely, but then you're back onto something that's still moving along. So when I'm reading on the train and the bus, I think about things like that because I'm constantly being interrupted and getting off and changing lines, and so it's nice to have a lot of good stopping places, and this book had a lot of good stopping places.
You know, you sort of talk about this idea of sort of reading kind of in the past and in the present in some ways. And that's sort of how I experienced one of my selections this year too. It's the first volume in a two-part diary, an Italian war diary by a writer named Iris Origo. And she was actually the daughter of a British woman and a wealthy American, and she married an Italian aristocrat. And so she had kind of entree to all these different worlds once she lived in Italy. And this is what helped her become this sort of great observer of what was unfolding in the late 1930s in Italy as Mussolini had come to power. And it appeared that, in fact, the Italians would probably ally themselves with the Germans in war against England and likely the United States. One of the things in reading this book is knowing, of course, what happened afterwards. So there's this terrible sense of knowing what's to come and feeling sort of this helplessness. And in fact, Iris Origo herself sort of conveys this helplessness. Even as she's reporting and sort of acknowledging that the Italian people don't want war, they seem sort of to somehow helplessly be falling into it in spite of themselves. Now, like all great diarists, she kind of keeps herself out of it. So she's doing a lot of observing, and she would actually have had quite a lot to write about herself, I think. She would have made a fascinating topic herself. But she also has this great eye and ear for the stories that she hears. Her godfather was actually the American ambassador to Rome. So she had these connections and she could hear what was going on in Rome and elsewhere in Italy as Italy is finding itself sort of being drawn into war against its own will, I suppose. But she has this great little anecdote in the story, and I'm just going to take a minute to read it. As she reports, a charming story is being told in Rome. Last week, the Mother Superior of the Casa della Divina Provvidenza in Turin, which was Don Bosco's wonderful charity, which cares for over 300 destitute orphans, cripples, blind people, etc., came to Rome, much troubled, to ask the Pope what she should do with her charges in case of war. Well, she was told that His Holiness would not receive her that day, but that meanwhile she could state her problems to one of his secretaries, and was ushered down a long passage into a small, dimly lit sitting room. As she sat there, waiting and praying, the door opened, and to her stupefaction, the Pope himself entered, alone. She knelt and kissed his ring, and then, still confused by his unexpected appearance and hardly looking up, she told him of her perplexity and distress. When she had finished, he spoke. "Have no fear, my daughter," he said. "Go back to Turin, resume your work there. There will be no war." Without waiting for an answer, he turned and was gone. A few minutes later, having collected herself, the nun was about to get up and leave, when the door opened again and a priest came in, saying that His Holiness would be able to receive her tomorrow. "But I have seen him," she cried. "He has just left me. Impossible." The priest looked at her as if she had gone mad. The Pope, he said, had spent the last hour in the company of a secretary in the Vatican Gardens. She repeated the conversation. Then the priest took her to a long gallery in which the walls were hung with the portraits of the more recent popes. "Look at their faces. Whom did you see?" he asked. After a quick glance, she said, "That one." It was Pius X, the simple and saintly pope whose death in 1914 was hastened by the outbreak of the last war. The priest nodded. She was not the first, he said, to whom the pope had appeared in the last few weeks, and always he had brought the same message. The nun returned to Turin, comforted. And of course, she would really not be comforted because of what would unfold in the coming months. Now, obviously, it's a two-part diary, so I really recommend reading both in tandem, because you should. But A Chill in the Air really is, I think, the better of the two, if I had to choose. So I don't know.
If
maybe
you're only going to read one.
If you're only going to read one, read A Chill in the Air, even though I think you'll know how it turns out. But we sort of began this conversation by talking about how we read and how we come to the books we decide we want to read. And
well, you know, I didn't say that much substantively about The Unpunished Vice, White's memoir. And even just noticing that you, one of your selections was this diary, I found myself, since being an editor at the magazine, being extremely interested in memoirs and diaries of writers or by writers, and kind of trying to get in their heads and understand something about their process, about how they created the great essays and novels and books that they did. And one thing about The Unpunished Vice is that because it's about a great novelist's reading life, he really is very explicit about what he borrowed from this novelist or author, or what he took from this particular writer, or how he learned about this or that technique. And so it's really a very interesting book in that sense, if you're an aspiring writer, to kind of, it's almost like a, like you're taking a seminar with him. And White did teach seminars for years at both Johns Hopkins and Princeton in their creative writing program. So in a lot of ways, I think it's some of his almost lecture notes distilled. And he's a very promiscuous reader. He talks a lot about French literature, like Colette. He talks a lot about Japanese literature, these kind of unexpected byways that sort of taught him something. And so for me, as a writer and as an editor, the book was especially interesting. And as I said, I've just found in general writers' memoirs and diaries to be things I've been especially interested since working at Commonweal.
Yeah, and I like the idea of sort of promiscuous reading too. And I mean, so what do we have lined up next?
I've been reading Portrait of a Lady by Henry James because I wanted something small and light.
Wonder where you got that idea.
I thought that, I'd read so much, as Matt says, about the craft of writing, works by journalists, reporting, nonfiction. I wanted to go back into fiction because I think it can give access to something that nonfiction can't quite touch, which is the realm of the imagination. And so James is describing, I think, these private worlds that exist inside of our heads, but that have public consequences. So, you know, I wanted something that was just so far outside of our current, let's call it, divided political environment. And I wanted the story of a portrait of a person, a person learning to make decisions, a person that has to decide the course of the rest of her life. But it's also deeply enjoyable. So I find myself, even today, I was riding the subway, and I lost it completely at the description of one of Isabel Archer, who's the main character, one of her suitors, Casper Goodwood. And James is always playing with names.
one of the greatest names.
The most wooden characters. But so, I this kind of enjoyment, the pleasure that you can take from reading is something that certainly not only the magazine as an institution encourages, but one of the things that I find most inspiring about my colleagues is I know that when I get off the subway and I go in to talk about it, there will be somebody there to listen. So that's what I – so you can expect many more comments about Henry James and other things.
I've been reading a lot of contemporary fiction lately, I think as sort of a backlash to finishing my – MFA in nonfiction in May, and so I've been reading a lot of fiction. I just read Britt Bennett's The Mothers. I read Elif Patalman's The Idiot this year, which was probably my favorite book I read this year, but didn't want to write about it for Christmas critics because everyone's written about that book, but I loved it. I'm reading Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad right now. Don't love it. I have a bad habit of reading to prizes. It's just a way that I create lists for myself. And because that book won the Pulitzer Prize, I picked it up. I'm always thinking about how people decide what to read next. And I think that's because I've just finished up school and I don't have syllabi anymore to tell me what to read.
But isn't there a liberation in that?
Totally liberation. But also just, do I go back and read all the things from the literary past that I want to read. Like, do I go back and read Henry James and Dostoevsky and Graham Greene and all these things that I feel like I should read that are on my list and that I want to read? Or do I sort of keep up with what's coming out now? Like, mm-hmm. right now, I've been reading novels that have come out in the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. So I think the answer is some of both. But sometimes I do wish my colleagues could just write me a syllabus and I could go down the list and check it off.
Consider it done. I think that's assignment staff-wide. So, Matt, what do you got coming up? Anything you're looking forward to or enjoying right now?
Well, I'm always reading a lot of nonfiction, kind of for mainly history, political science, political theory. So I'm in the midst of Helena Rosenblatt's The Lost History of Liberalism, which I actually hope to review in our pages. Mm-hmm. So I read a lot of things like that. But in terms of fiction, maybe something different. I've never read Fanny Howe's, what is it, Indivisible?
Indivisible,
mm-hmm. which Chris Wyman has always strongly recommended, and other people have recommended to me. Griffin's nodding.
Sorry, yes, I'm nodding. I'm affirming you and your desire to read that
so
book.
So that'll be kind of my, like, I take a novel home with me over Christmas reading. And I also, I've been, after Mark Strand died, the poet, I bought his collected poems, and I've been meaning to really, like, do a deep dive into them. So over, when I have a little more time off over the holidays, that might be something else I dip into. So I always try to have some fiction and poetry to leaven leaven my more arduous reading in nonfiction.
You know, and just to sort of, I guess, reveal to the audience a little bit about what happens even with our Christmas critics is, believe it or not, it serves to recommend the books that we're reading to one another. And I've mentioned to Matt on a number of occasions that I've never read Edwin White, and it's time now that this, I think that's what I'm going to be doing this winter. But at the moment, I'm reading a kind of a memoir, but it is truly a memoir, but it's written like a novel, called Really the Blues by Mez Mezro, the early 20th century jazz clarinetist and alto saxophonist. And I'm just finding it really incredible. It's written in the argot, I guess, of early jazz and blues. But Mezro ends up just being a really fascinating character. And of course, it helps that he hangs out with people like Louis Armstrong and Jack Benny and a number of other folks. And he spends a lot of time in Harlem and New Orleans and Paris. So he's sort of there when hot jazz is happening, and he helps create it. And it's just a really fantastic book. And it also, I think, it's another from the New York Review of Books Press, which I think we all sort of have a little bit of a, not to give free advertising to NYRB Press. But I think sometimes that is how I go about choosing what I'm going to read.
Yeah. They do have a holiday sale going on at the moment on their website. And, you buy four, you get 40% off.
And you know you're in a good bookstore, I guess, when you can go over to they have a display and it's just all those, nicely colored spines looking out at you. And see, we're already. But there are other publishers out there as well, and we should also acknowledge them. So. Well, if there are any final words, does anybody want to just jump in with anything and just one last recommendation or thought?
Merry Christmas. Happy reading.
Happy reading. And make sure to check out our Christmas Critics. It's in the December 1st issue. And of course, it's on our website. And there's others besides just the four of us as well. So you can take a look. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.